Oregon is not known as a very diverse place. It's very white with relatively low numbers for people of color, which triggers an obvious question. Why aren't there more black people in Oregon? It's a simple and elegant question. And also the title of a long-running conversation in the Oregon Conversation Project offered by Oregon Humanities. The program travels to far corners of the state, Cave Junction yesterday, Cottage Grove tonight at the public library. Our next guest leads the conversation. Walida Imarisha taught at Portland State University's Black Studies Department, Oregon State University's Women, Gender, Sexuality Studies Department, and in the English Department at Southern New Hampshire University. She's recently released a book called Angels with Dirty Faces, Three Stories of Crime, Prison, and Redemption, which examines the criminal justice system from multiple angles. Walida Imarisha, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how long has it that you've been leading this particular conversation of the Conversation Project?
I started, I think, almost 5 years ago with this project. I've been with the Conversation Project. I was with them for 7 years.
I noticed that there are other other conversations you do within the project, including alternatives to incarceration, for example.
Yes, I actually started out that was the first program that I did.
Mm-hmm. So the question itself about why are there so few black people in Oregon, why aren't there more black people in Oregon, certainly historical answers to the question. Is this pretty much a historical tour to in search of an answer to that?
Well, I mean, I'm a historian and also a history nerd at heart, so I think that we can't begin to understand the present or the future without understanding the past. And so we look at the historical foundations of race, identity, and power in the state, but we bring it up through the modern era and look at current racial disparities and statistics around the ways that this history is still very much impacting all of Oregon, especially communities of color and black communities.
And Oregon's answer basically at the beginning of its existence was just to exclude people of color from the state. Wasn't that the basic approach?
Well, yeah, the foundation of Oregon, the founding idea was that Oregon would be a white homeland. Oregon would be a racist white utopia where people could come and build the kind of white society that they had dreamed of away from, quote unquote, the problems of the day, which meant to them people of color.
We have talked about exclusion laws a bunch of times here on the program. And in fact, some of these didn't even come off the books until well into the 20th century, right?
Into the 21st century, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the last one to fall?
So the first racial exclusion law, which was a black racial exclusion law, that's what they were, was in 1844 when Oregon was still a territory. And Oregon both outlawed slavery and included the first black racial exclusionary law that banned black folks from living here. And it also included the lash law that said that black people would be publicly whipped every 6 months up to 39 lashes until we left the state. And so that was the first black exclusionary law. Exclusionary law that lasted the longest was the one that was written into the Constitution in 1859 that banned black folks from living in Oregon. So the law was repealed in 1926, but the language was not removed from the Constitution until 2001.
Wow. You know, I just was reading a little bit about the lash laws. Those are pretty unbelievably cruel. So if you stayed in Oregon as a person of color, then you risked getting lashed every 6 months.
Yes, up to 39 times.
Wow. So this is meant to be a conversation project event. So it's a conversation. How do you present things at the beginning of this? I mean, how do you get the conversation rolling?
Yeah, so I've created the Oregon Black History Timeline. It's a set of slides that I hang on the wall and have participants tour of key moments in Oregon racial history, starting from the 1500s up until the end of the 20th century. And so folks actually tour in pairs, looking at the timeline, talking about it, and then we come back together in the large group. I find that this is a much more engaging and useful way than me lecturing for an hour about this information.
I've been looking at the timeline because it is provided online, and noticed that one of the things that finally broke the ice, I guess, after the Civil War was the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad finally began to bring African Americans into Oregon in larger numbers.
Yes, that's very true, that the first large influx of black folks came in the 1880s with the completion of the railroads, that they found an incredibly brutally hostile environment when they came. And Portland at that time and well into the 20th century was considered to be the most segregated city north of the Mason-Dixon line. And so those black folks who came certainly had a hard road ahead of them.
I was going to ask about comparisons to the southern states, and you just provided one, so that was not a happy one. How did Portland compare to other parts of the state, though? I mean, you hear about sundown laws in places like Grants Pass. I mean, the Klan was certainly very active across the entire state in the 1920s.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this, again, the entire idea, not just for Oregon, but the Oregon Territory, which is important, right? The Oregon Territory was Oregon, Washington, Idaho, parts of Wyoming, and parts of Montana, right? So that means basically the entire Northwest wanted to be a racist white utopia, a whites-only homeland. And I think that is an important framework because it shows that this ideology is something that's embedded not just in Oregon, but it's something that is embedded actually in the nation as a whole. And that I actually believe Oregon is an incredibly useful case study for the rest of the nation because Oregon wrote it down so blatantly and, you know, pun intended, in black and white to be able to study that. But the same ideologies, policies, and practices shaped every state in the nation and the nation as a whole.
So when you say embedded, I mean, is it embedded in the culture? Is it embedded in the history? Both? I'm just trying to figure out at what point it ceases to be something that people think about in today's culture.
I think it's absolutely embedded. And I think that, I think it's your identity certainly depends on whether or not you think about it in today's culture. I often say, you know, that there are two Oregons, there are two, you know, Portland's happening, that, you know, that the experiences for white folks in Oregon and the experiences for people of color in Oregon are so, you know, diametrically opposed, and that white folks often have no understanding about what it's like to live in Oregon. So, I mean, this was something that was embedded deeply. It was the foundation of this state and this region, and so it was embedded into the institutions, into the laws, into government, into culture, into economics, into everything that shapes all of our lives, and has become such a foundational part that it is just business as usual. And so when so many people have come to me and said, yes, when I moved to Oregon, I was like, why is it so white? And I think that that shows how deeply embedded this is in every aspect of our society and how much work it is going to take to do deep institutional transformational change to pull this out.
I'm trying to come up with a metaphor in my mind, and I keep coming back to tumor in the sense that it has those long tentacles sometimes that gets into everything, and it's really, really hard to pull it all out.
Yes. I mean, I would say that it was more of the skeletal frame, and that is definitely difficult to replace, but absolutely needs to be because the entire society has grown around it like a skeletal frame. It is the thing that is holding together this region and also this nation. And so I think that we can't make real change until we actually acknowledge that.
Walida Imarisha is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She leads the Oregon Conversation Project program. Why aren't there more black people in Oregon? It can be seen tonight at the Cottage Grove Library, starting at 6:30 and ending at 8:30. You can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Morgan in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey, so much for having me.
Sure.
Walida, thank you so much for bringing this important conversation to Southern Oregon. My question is around, to your knowledge, is any of this information being presented in our public school system in Oregon? And if not, what can citizens do to help bring this information to a broader audience?
Okay, thanks for that, Morgan.
Yeah, thanks for that great question, Morgan. And I think that that's really important. Unfortunately, this is not information that has been presented in the public school system historically. I call the subtitle is a hidden history. So this is something that has not been presented and is not being presented as any part of mandated curriculum in Oregon public schools. And I actually did a presentation a couple years ago, mostly for public school teachers and administrators, and 80% of them said that before that program, they had no idea about key pieces of Oregon racial history, like the black exclusionary laws.
Really? Even that hadn't been mentioned up to that point?
No, and these are public school teachers and administrators, and the teachers especially were incredibly upset and said, how are we supposed to be educating students when we're not being given that information? But it shows how inaccessible it is to teachers, let alone to students. And so I think that, you know, that there are different programs that are available. OPB has done some great work on radio, on television, and just finding ways to share these is a kind of short-term solution. But the long-term solution is obviously making deep curricular changes in the schools so that the true history around race, identity, and power is something that students are given in this state so they can understand the state they live in.
I have to believe there have been efforts to do that in the Portland school system, certainly, where you live. I mean, have there been?
Oh, there have been many efforts to do that, and there has been immense pushback around that. And so, you know, I think that there's a long history of trying to get this done. I think the piece that's really important is to recognize that, you know, Black communities specifically and communities of color in general have never been passive victims. We have been active change makers. And so the only reason that any advances on racial justice have happened is the determination, resilience, creativity of communities of color. And so, you know, communities of color in this state have tried for centuries in some cases to get different changes made to advance racial justice, and have been met with immense pushback. But they, you know, they continue trying and pushing and regrouping and making advances in spite of that.
What are the reasons given for not putting this in public schools, for example, from the people who are pushing back?
There are lots of different reasons. Some of it is around whether it's age-appropriate material or not. Some of it is about the ways that it's presented and that some of the curriculum that was developed, oftentimes curriculum that focuses on communities of color, not just here in Oregon but nationally, isn't considered to be academically rigorous enough. And so there are lots of different kind of code words and excuses that are used that I think allow people not to talk about the fundamental issue at hand, which is not wanting to talk about the foundation of Oregon as a racist state and to talk about the ways that still very much functions in all of our institutions, including public education.
How universally across racial lines is the story known? I mean, my original question was that I have to assume since you go to so many rural areas, you get lots of white faces, but I suppose that is the point as well. But is the story as well known by people of color in Oregon as it is by white people?
I think that, again, this is a hidden history is the subtitle. And so even, you know, communities of color who experience pieces of it and, you know, firsthand and who experience certainly the cumulative impact of this history often don't know about the specifics because there are very few places that you can learn about things like the Black exclusionary laws, learn about the things that, you know, Oregon had the highest per capita Klan membership in the country, learn about the ways that redlining and, you know, brutal segregation really work to depower and control, contain, and exploit the Black community, you know, especially in Portland. And so there are very few public places where you can interact with that information. So communities of color have pieces of it, obviously, and are experts around those pieces because they've experienced it firsthand. But kind of seeing the entire historical scope, I think, is something that is needed to be able to really figure out how to dig out this institutional racism.
Are the conversations very different town to town? I mean, you're going to find a very different kind of conversation tonight in Cottage Grove from what you had last night in Cave Junction?
Yeah, I mean, one of the goals of the Conversation Project is to create dialogue and conversations rather than, you know, just kind of scholars coming in and lecturing. And so we, you know, I try and create space so that we can have conversations that are relevant locally and that folks who are present are interested in. So we often talk about, you know, we'll talk about the foundational pieces everywhere, but then given what folks are really interested in or are really wanting to dig into, that's what we explore from stop to stop. So it's exciting, I think, for participants to be able to guide that piece of it.
And how much do the events of the day get into the conversation, too? I have to believe that since Michael Brown's death in Ferguson and Freddie Gray's death in Baltimore, and we can keep on going with more names and more cities, but that people are much more aware of injustice against African Americans in the country.
I mean, I think that those offer immense opportunities, and I think that it's not just the murders of these Black folks by police, but it is the organizing by black communities to not only raise awareness, but to say we will not tolerate this kind of brutal, you know, repression happening anymore, right? Because unfortunately, the statistics around black folks being killed by the police have been this high for decades. And so, unfortunately, the oppression is not new, but what is powerful and exciting is the resistance and this resurgence of things like Black Lives Matter and Hands Up, Don't Shoot, saying, you know, we will not allow this to continue as business as usual anymore. And so definitely those are places that have offered opportunities to have conversations and to connect those, you know, with Oregon. The criminalization, blackness was criminalized in Oregon. To be in Oregon was to be a criminal, right? Right up until the 1860s when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed. All you had to do was be black and be in Oregon to be a criminal and to be seen as criminal. And so I think that very much connects to the ways that black folks are being brutally killed by police across this nation.
Mike in Medford sent an email. He says, "What an absolutely amazing program. Thank you for your good work. As my young mixed-race niece always says in Medford, where are all the brown people?" She takes skin color quite literally. Our history was Native, Chinese, and racist. Klan ideology needs to be exposed and learned from. So there are lessons to learn here, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, we can't change the future without learning the lessons of the past. My framework is, you know, in school, we're often taught history is this sort of linear progression towards greatness, an unbroken line from savagery to civilization. I think that that's absolutely untrue. I think that at best, history is a spiral. If we know we have been in this place, we've had these conversations before, we can use that information to continue to move us upwards. But unfortunately, in Oregon and in the nation, we end up not doing that, and so we just run around in circles.
I'm going to guess that people ask when we leave here tonight, and they'll probably ask it in Cottage Grove tonight, what do we do? So what do you say?
Yes, and that's one of the things that's really exciting about this tour and why this is actually the second year that I've done this tour. It's a partnership with Oregon Humanities and also with the Rural Organizing Project, which is an incredible organization working in rural areas to promote racial justice and social justice as well. And so the Rural Organizing Project, I do my program, and then they do a short session afterwards saying, so what does this mean for us here locally? What are changes we can make? What are ways to get involved? They have additional meetings set up, so folks who come can plug right into local issues right there and say, well, I'm really interested in working on education. The Rural Organizing Project says, great, let's do that. The last tour, actually an organization founded out of the tour, and there was organizing campaigns that came out of the tour because Rural Organizing Project is sort of using this as, you know, as a way to have these conversations get on the same page and get folks motivated to move.
All right. Amazing stuff that goes on out there. This is the Oregon Conversation Project session. Why aren't there more black people in Oregon? It'll be tonight at 6:30 at the Public Library in Cottage Grove, sponsored by the Blackberry Pie Society. I don't know what that is. On the Cottage Grove Public Library. Walida Imarisha leads it and has for a long time now. Walida, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Take care.